professor. An assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Toronto and the Women's Mental Health Program at the Centre for Addiction and Mental Health, and staff psychiatrist at the Hospital for Sick Children. So tell us a little bit about the topic tonight, and then we'll introduce, you know, let's introduce it. Okay. Professor Ralph Strauss, South African-born Professor Ralph Strauss, MD, MHA, is the medical director of Meine Yeshua's Mental Health Wing, one of Israel's leading psychiatrists. He is a professor of psychiatry at the Sachs School of Medicine, chief editor of the Israel Journal of Psychiatry, serves on Israel's National Committees on Mental Health and Suicide Prevention. He's also an avid marathon runner. I can vouch for that. And Rabbi Mordechai Tochina, after serving as a pulpit rabbi for 12 years, Rabbi Mordechai Tochina became the founding Rosh Beit Midrash of Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Tov in 2009. Among his activities, Rabbi Tochina teaches medical ethics and medical halacha classes here, right? For medical professionals, these classes are approved for continuing medical education credit through the Faculty of Medicine, University of Toronto. I have to thank Rabbi David Grunland for putting us all together. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you all for coming out on a very cold night. I'm not used to this weather. I live in Netanya. This is not Netanya weather.
Cold.
I know, but it's for me, it's cold. Okay, so I think we'll start off by 3 to 5 minutes on the issue of eating disorder in the order I presented you, and then by that time, bye-bye. Okay, excellent. Okay, Leo, you're on.
So I'm going to keep my comments brief because I think what's more important is that we have a conversation with the community. What I would say is that eating disorders are more common than people appreciate, and certainly in the adolescent population, it's a problem that we don't have enough treatment for. Not in the Jewish community, not in the Orthodox Jewish community, not in Ontario as a whole. And when I say it's common, I mean it. It's actually the second most common chronic illness in adolescent girls, second only to asthma. So we're talking about all illnesses. If you look at Canadian data, the rate of obesity in adolescent girls is somewhere around 10%. That's in the general population. The rate of eating disorders in the same population is 18%. I would say, how does one get to be an epidemic and the other one's a rare disorder when the numbers don't support it? And in the Jewish community, it's higher. The rates of eating disorders in the Jewish community in Toronto are probably higher. They're probably closer to 1 in 5, 1 in 4 when you look at adolescent girls. So we all know or are related to someone with an eating disorder. And chances are that girl is not getting treatment. Chances are it's a secret. No one talks about it. And if we do talk about it, we tend to not treat it like we do other illnesses. We tend to think about it as, what's her parents doing? Can't they just get her to eat? She's just doing this for attention. So there's nothing wrong with attention. By the way, we all want attention. But it's actually a serious mental health disorder, and it's a fatal one, right? So if I had to choose between having a kid who had an eating disorder or a kid who was a little heavy, I'd take the heavy, because kids with eating disorders, and adults too, they have a mortality rate of somewhere between 10 to 15%, right? So I have 12 kids on my unit, right? I always do the math. 1 in 10 may not survive. So it's stark. The mortality rate in anorexia is higher than in some of the childhood leukemia, right? Just to put it in context. And the kicker here is that if people get the right treatment at the right time, particularly if they're under 18, they can make a full recovery. And we, in Ontario, cannot provide the right treatment for these kids. So they go on to a chronic illness, and a number of them will die. What other illness do we allow that to happen in this province? Right? Think about it. If we said, we have a treatment for schizophrenia, and if we treat you before you're 18, we can help you make a full recovery. Everywhere would they'd be starting institutes for this. Right? But if you don't get to the treatment before you turn 18, chances are you're going to stay sick if you're still sick at 18. It would be an outrage. We'd be rushing to treat everyone with a disorder, And yet here in Ontario, I can't even guarantee that in Toronto, a girl who needs the right treatment is going to get it. And that's an injustice. And I think we need to do something about it. I'll stop there.
First of all, it's really good to be here, and it's an honor to speak in front of you. And even more importantly, it's a humbling experience to be here in the presence of a true expert in eating disorders. And Dr. Pinchas, from my experience with her in the last day or two, she's with her knowledge, should be one of the world leaders in the field, and you're very lucky to have her here in Toronto. And I hope that people appreciate what they have there, because I'm learning about the field still, and I'll tell you about that soon. And just also to say that to be in the presence of our lucky experts such as Rabbi Tochin, it's also really a pleasure to be here and an honor. Thank you. In Manei Yeshua, essentially the concept of Manei Yeshua as a community hospital is that the hospital, as opposed to a general hospital, exists by looking out into the community, seeing what the needs are in the community, and then building that kind of service, rather than saying, can we build a medical service and come to us with what you want. So essentially this hospital that we built now in the middle of Bnei Brak, primarily for the Orthodox population, is saying, you know, mental illness is okay, it exists, and we need to manage it, and there's nothing to be ashamed of. You know, when you go into any hospital in Israel, you know, you can buy coke from a machine, so too you can buy flowers. When you go to, and if I asked you how many people have visited someone in a medical hospital, many of you would say, you put up your hands, but if I were to ask you how many of you ever visited someone in a psychiatry hospital, very few of you would put up your hands. Unless it was a close family member, because of the stigma of mental illness, it's not addressed, and traditionally psychiatry patients end up in suboptimal conditions, with 6 to 10 per room sometimes, and are neglected. And so what we're doing is we're saying no, mentally ill should have a voice and should be managed, and there should be parity between services. So when we look now at the Orthodox population around us, we see that eating disorders is a serious problem. And it appears that eating disorders in Israel is more common amongst the Orthodox population than in the non-Orthodox population. And that goes against what we all have our stigma against. To say, oh, eating disorders are because, you know, they're looking at fashion, and it's all because it's not so simple. It's not so simple. And eating disorders is a very, very complex disorder, a very, very complex approach to understanding it. And because of there's something about it that you go through the training as a psychiatrist. I wasn't told about anything about eating disorders. I went through 4 years of training at a good place, I think, at Einstein in New York, and eating disorders never came up at all. We weren't trained in it. So you finish your psychiatry and you're expected to know how to manage it. And that's part of what we're doing here, to try and learn about that and to see what other people are doing and what works. And in our population, because it's such an incident population and because it's so common, the families know that if they send their patients, their children, to non-Orthodox, to secular programs, they all leave their Judaism. And that's true. They're also close to 100% leaving of Yahadut, of Yiddishkeit. So the families in the Frum community in Israel are saying, you know what, I prefer that my child stay at home with a potential 20% risk of her dying than send her to one of these secular programs. And I know that 100% she's going to leave Yiddishkeit. And for me, that's like she's not alive anymore, which is a crazy thing to hear. But I've heard it on several occasions straight from the mouths of parents of young adolescents. When I say young adolescents, I'm also mentioning, why don't I say young girls? Because it's really both, and that's part of the stigma also. We all think, oh, it's all girls, but it's not. Because in fact, what we're seeing also in Israel, in the Frum community, the ratio, even though the ratio still of girls to boys is higher, there's a much greater number of boys to girls, relatively, than in the secular, and the non-Frum population. And that we can also discuss the reasons for later. So there's something about eating disorder that's very, very hard to approach, hard to understand, and because that, the services are not there. And that's what we're trying to change. We're trying to say, okay, you know, people have issues and we can address them and we need to address them, and there's nothing to be ashamed of by doing, because these are illnesses. And it's not an issue because the girls are manipulative or bad, or because we put a moral judgment on this thing. It's just getting to eat. It's much more complex than that, and maybe that's some of the things we'll discuss tonight.
Thank you both. I'm honored to be invited, although frankly I'd rather be sitting over there, because really, while it's true that I speak on medical ethics issues and I've spoken on mental health issues, I've never spoken on eating disorders, not because I'm shy, but because I'm ignorant. It's really not an area which gets discussed much, going back to the point about stigma. It's not an area where it shows up in the headlines quite as much, although it should. And so I'm grateful to be invited to be on the panel, because honestly, otherwise I wouldn't make it out in the evening to be here. So at least it's an opportunity then for me to be here and to listen, if only with a better seat than everybody else. I sent out an email this morning advertising the program, and as I said there, I'm a parent of teens. Two boys and two girls, and from my perspective, parenting teenagers without consulting experts is like diving into the deep end of a swimming pool without lessons. You could survive, but why in the world would you do that? Right? It doesn't make any sense. The only thing that I would say, and this goes back to my shul rabbi experience, is to emphasize the importance of community support. It's always hard. When you know somebody who is dealing with something or has an illness in their family, it's always hard to know what to say. And there's a sense of like, well, maybe if I don't say anything, maybe they don't want me to say anything. And then when you add to that, issues of mental health with the stigma that comes with it, maybe they really don't want to talk. And that becomes an easy excuse for not saying anything. And we sort of, hang back and don't speak. But I think that's a big mistake. One of the strengths that Jewish community has is the community piece of it, the fact that we are there for each other. I brought with me a quote from a blog that I saw 10 years ago, which has really stuck with me. I'm sort of torn about reading it aloud or not reading aloud, because I always get emotional when I read it out loud, but it's worth the read. Did you see this? It was from a blog called Wings Like a Dove. By a woman who identified herself as Rivka, and she talks about her experience one Shabbos in shul when she was crying. And she says, "I write to you today as one of the unseen. It hurts to not be seen. It hurts even more to suffer alone and in silence. I have a mental illness, depression in particular. I hide it well most of the time. Today I did not hide it. I cried openly in shul. I trembled from the sheer pain of it, surrounded by some 200 people during the Kiddush luncheon that followed, and still you did not see me. I stumbled out of the social hall, blinded by tears I could not control and sobs that left me unable to breathe, and still..." You can take over.
"And still no one saw me. I took refuge in the chapel and sobbed aloud. In the past, I would hide in the bathroom, taking great pains to silence my tears when anyone came in. Today I did not. I sought solace, but I did not hide. People came into the chapel for various reasons, to look for a lost talis, read the newspaper, find a book in the library. Even still, I remained unseen. When my sobs exhausted themselves, I found my peace and emotional numbness. I rose to leave the chapel, falling onto a chair in my weakened state. One man remained in the chapel facing me. He did not even bother to look up. I left the chapel unseen."
So, thank you, first of all. It's true that it's hard to know what to say, and it's hard to know how not to offend. I have a friend who has a daughter who has an eating disorder, and learned from him that you're not supposed to say, you look good, or something along those lines. That in and of itself can be hurtful. So, like, if I can't say that, what can I say? So I actually, I don't know if it fits now or later in the program, but I would want the panelists to give advice on what to say to people who have this themselves or have it in their family.
So I want to thank the panelists for addressing this important issue. I can speak from a perspective as a shul rabbi that this is an important issue in our community. And it's something that I was hoping to address as part of a group that meets once a year here in Toronto, a consortium of synagogues and Mount Sinai Hospital that work on mental health on an ongoing basis. And this year, it's something that we hope to address in the years to come as well. I want to just call back on one of the themes that came up earlier. I want to focus a little bit on the quality of religious populations and non-religious populations when it comes to eating disorders. I know that Dr. Strauss mentioned it in his remarks, and I wanted to ask, how does this compare, and what does it say about religious populations if there is in fact a difference?
I can talk about the sort of Toronto experience. I think in Toronto, the numbers are high in the Orthodox community, but they're not that much higher than in the Jewish community as a whole. They're high across the board. So maybe what you've got is the ceiling effect. They can't get any higher across the board. And I think that sounds like it's different in Israel, where it's higher in the Orthodox community. I would say here, though, and I can only speak to my experience, I've worked with a number of Orthodox patients in the secular hospital, because that's all we have. And no patient of mine has ever left the Orthodox community when they got treatment here. And again, that may be something different, maybe going on in the secular hospitals in Israel, where the politics may be different. But we've worked with rabbis, we've always provided kosher food, we've never... I think I would say they've always had our respect.
In our program, we have an outpatient program for eating disorders, and what we found is that the adolescent girls that are coming to us, the issues we'd expect are related around, and why is there an eating disorders issues? And we always say it's related to shidduchim, right? Because everything's on paper. Because there's no love in the relationship before they get married. So everything's on paper. So how they look, and you know, you look at there's even this issue. Don't just look at the young girl. Look at her mother. And these are all the things that are out there. But I think that's a very simplified approach. And that could all be true. But I think it goes much further than that, because a lot of the Orthodox girls that we're seeing are almost parentified children, and they're very, very perfectionist, and they sometimes, usually the elder siblings in a family of 10, sometimes 15 children, and they've taken a lot of roles of the younger, to looking after the younger siblings, and it comes across in some of the cases that they don't have an ability to express themselves. So that them expressing who they are and their control of their lives becomes through the eating, because there's no really other way to do that, at least on a subconscious level. And that's something that we work with, allowing them to be themselves. In other words, in an adolescent, you're looking at individualism, you're looking at self-esteem, looking at self-actualization. And if there's no really way to do that, sometimes it comes out in suboptimal fashion. So that's amongst the girls, and that's some of the things that we look at. But amongst the boys, what's fascinating is that the approach to eating disorders is very, very different. And maybe that's one of the reasons why we're seeing so much of it relatively in the boys. Because when it comes to the boys, it's not an issue of I want to be thin because it looks good and because of body image. It's because holding back on food is considered to be something hard, because I'm kovashet yitzro. I'm conquering my desires. And that's what you see, because it's seen as a high level that we conquer things. So whether it's conquering not speaking Lashon Hara, that's one way. But one way of doing it, also conquering what you're eating. And there's some rabbanim who talk about the fact that there are evils. One prominent rabbi, and I won't mention his name, is relatively recently spoken about the evils of sugar and oil and salt, and I forget the fourth. High fats, okay? I mean, it's fascinating that he came out in one of his Joshua speaking about it, and the kids pick up on that and say, wow, that's something I need to hold back on. So it's kind of a seatism. So it's not a question of body image. So that kind of falls away. And then the management of it is complete. Has its uniqueness in the Orthodox world. So for example, in the secular world, and maybe that's why a lot of the children who the adolescents who've been treated, the Yiddishkeit, is that okay? If your issues around control, if your issues around and not being able to express yourself, let it all out. You know, expose yourself to the world and take on other things and allow yourself to express and to experience and to see what's out there. And therefore, part of that is sometimes life, becoming to Hanukkah, life can be blinding. We know that from the Hellenistic experience. So that's why the children. That's why we think that what's happening, and then the management is also very different. And maybe we can talk about that a bit later. How the certain unique challenges that we're coming across in the Orthodox world in terms of management of eating disorders, that's a little different to what it would have been if they weren't Orthodox.
So let me ask another question about this religious personality and eating disorders. What are the impediments to a person getting treatment when it comes to the religious community as compared to the secular community? What gets in the way of a person being properly treated for this disorder?
Well, first of all, availability of programs. You know, we now, by virtue of the fact that we have a seven-story psychiatry building in the middle of Bnei Brak, says something really about changing stigma. Stigma is a massive issue in the Orthodox population. In general, in the world, stigma is an issue. When I ask you now what's the commonest diagnosis of anyone in hospital right now in Toronto, I can tell you now from the south of Israel down, because I used to be in the Ministry of Health managing the outpatient. So how many people right now in Israel in hospitalized for cardiac disease? 100 in the center of Israel, 100, 120. How many with lung disease? 140. How many with cancer? Maybe 100. How many with broken bones? 150. How many with schizophrenia? 600. So no one talks about it, but the commonest diagnosis, and I'm sure it's the same in the area in Toronto, the commonest diagnosis of anyone in hospital right now is psychiatric diagnosis, but people don't talk about it. 2/3 of people go through their life with some and going to experience some kind of psychiatric illness. Only about 1/3 get treatment. So it's in the general population that's like that, and it's nothing to be ashamed of. But we put a stigma on that, and especially in the Orthodox population, where relationship doesn't come up, it becomes everything gets put on the shidduchim, so everything's on paper. So what happens in the Orthodox population, for example, people are not wealthy, but they're paying astronomical amounts of money to go be treated privately, could just in case it be documented on some computer through the health funds, through the Kupat Cholim. And that's exploitation of a population that should not be. So we're offering this kind of service. We offer it gets covered by the health service, the health funds, and it's for free. No one pays. I'm talking about the cross-the-board psychiatric illness. The name of the hospital is given by Rav Chaim Kanievsky. We're out there and we're saying it's okay. It's okay. And part of the stigma is, you know, the biggest stigma in psychiatry is amongst actually staff, amongst mental health providers. That's what the studies have shown. And for example, we organize these special wings for families that families wouldn't see each other and patients wouldn't see other people's families. All bobomices. It's really not a problem. They love it. You know, we started having meeting with families once a month, went down to once every 2 weeks, and now we're once a week. That family members get together amongst themselves and have support groups and talk about it, and part of it is education. And the biggest stigma amongst mental illness is amongst us ourselves, because the families are thirsty for this kind of information.
That's true here too. I would say that the biggest stigma is within the healthcare system.
How does that work? What does that mean, that there's stigma among the... How does that work, that there's stigma among the healthcare system itself?
So I'll speak to the Toronto experience. You know, I think there's been lots of attempts to address stigma around mental health in the general community through media and schools, and people have just assumed that healthcare providers don't have that kind of stigma, that they're up to date, but they've kind of been left out. And to me, it feels like it's almost like there's more stigma in the system. We don't train people as they're coming up the ranks. And what they get exposed to in the hospitals is their supervisors and their negative opinions. And you see this in the emergency departments. You see this in the healthcare. If you have a health problem and you have, for instance, an eating disorder and you show up in the emerge, you may not actually be treated for your problem. I have seen people with true you know, who had heart disease with chest pain, be discharged from the eMERGE without even getting an EKG. And in the eating disorder world, we kind of keep a list in our head about what emergency departments are safe to go to, where at least you'll be treated with respect, and maybe, maybe you will actually get the medical assessment that you need. I feel like I'm a witness to crime sometimes. The number of times I've seen my patients be sent home from hospital with no services in conditions where, like, there's a really good chance that person's going to die. And they get sent home, and I don't, young people, I don't understand it.
And the inner talk of the system is basically, well, they're just crazy, so we're not going to treat them. Like,
they deserve it. They did it to themselves. And how many times do people hear someone with an eating disorder come to hospital where they're told, come back after you've eaten a meal. Come back after you've had dinner. Right? And in fact, sometimes when you've starved for a long time, to go home and have a meal is dangerous. Right? Because there's a thing called refeeding syndrome if you have too much nutrition all at once.
So is there a failure of the educational system, the medical educational system?
Absolutely.
No.
And I think also a lack of accountability. Right? If you get away with this once or twice, right, and no one stops you, right, there's no correction, it becomes the norm. You see your peers doing it. And it's not like doctors in emergencies are bad people, but if you're overworked and you're stressed and you already have this feeling like too many people use the system, you know, people with colds come to emerge, so you're already in a critical place, it's easy to absorb this kind of attitude, I think.
And part of it also, it's a system that requires a lot of, it's top heavy, needs a lot of staff to really do it well. Mm-hmm. And therefore the system, for example, in Israel, if 1.2% of the population have anorexia of the adolescents, 2-3% probably have bulimia, there are about 15,000 with anorexia in Israel. There are only 38 beds in the whole country for this. Why? Because it's very expensive. You need a lot of staff, and therefore if you add beds, they get filled up. It's an extra expense to the system, which is giving free health. So if the community are not saying, hey, you know, we need this kind of help, but the community are not standing up and saying, hey, you know, we need this, they're not going to give it. Part of the issue is that mentally ill don't have a voice. Mm-hmm. And the community needs to substitute for that and give a voice. But that expression of stigma is in many different areas. And I've also, my little hobby is the issue of the Holocaust. And every city that respects itself around the world has a Holocaust museum. But how many times have you ever seen a museum dedicated to the memory or to the study of what happened to the mentally ill during the Holocaust? Because it all began with the mentally ill. In fact, the whole idea of gas chambers started in 6 psychiatry hospitals, 5 in Germany, 1 in Austria, and only then it moved over to Poland with the Auschwitz, Treblinka, etc. There was only one death camp commander who ever headed a death camp, who was a doctor, Treblinka, and he headed a psychiatry hospital, so he knew what to do. But no one's heard about his name, I guess, yeah, Imfred Ebel, but everyone's heard about Mengele. But so there's something about mentally ill, and we don't talk about that. What happened to the Jewish mentally ill during the Holocaust? It's kind of this issue that no one ever, because that's part of the stigma, because they don't have a voice, and we want to be a voice for them. We want it to come also not just from within the profession, but society needs to say, hey, you know, the services are required, people are suffering, it's not out there, let's support them.
Maybe we can speak like a little bit about how eating disorders are treated, and perhaps also address the differences between how it's treated in a religious population as opposed to a secular population.
I would say in some ways there are differences, in some ways there are no differences. So I will speak as a clinician. Every person I treat is a person. And every family is unique, and every person has come to their illness in a unique way and lives in their own culture as individuals. And I think the treatment has to be personalized and individualized, and it's more about seeing and hearing and knowing your patient, and then being really practical about how you come up with a treatment plan. There are some things that are generic, right? We know there are certain medications that can be helpful. We know that working with the family and helping the family help their kid to eat. It's very helpful. Family therapy is very helpful. We know that re-nourishing the body helps the brain think more clearly. So they're generic things, but in the end, I am practical, and actually, I love working in the Orthodox community because you can use the community and you can use the thinking to help kids get better because there's meaning. You can use what you want is to help them find meaning in their life again, right? As opposed to being caught in this kind of superficial, empty number counting rat. It's like a little, I don't know, like one of those hamster wheel things. And there's lots of meaning in the community.
I would reflect everything that Dr. Pinchas said. I 100% agree. I think that in many ways the process is exactly the same. It's no different. Sometimes there are nuances you have to be aware of, and I'll give you a few of them. For example, what happens when we're dealing with the Haredi community, and part of the issue of refeeding and slowly is using Ensure. And Ensure is what? It's not Chalav Yisrael. There's no Chalav Yisrael Ensure. So what do you do with the population? He's dealing with a young man who wants to lose. He's losing it because he sees it as a higher spiritual thing. And he's told now by his doctor he has to have Ensure, which has got Chalav Akum. How do you manage it? Sorry? That's a problem. You can't, so you have to bring the rabbi in. We have a rabbi on staff who helps there. What happens with the issues, you know, you're eating meat and then you've got to have your insurance an hour later. But wait, you're supposed to wait 6 hours. What are you doing about that hour? So you bring in the rabbi again. He has to give a psak. It's okay. What happens if most of the therapists, in fact, there are very few male therapists who are experts necessarily in the management of eating disorders. In fact, we don't have any. So they're being treated by female therapists, and is that okay? So we can work both sides. With the doctor we have as a psychiatrist, but a male, but the therapist or female, so on both sides. So what happens when you want to do family-based therapy, because that's the principle, that's the basics of really what the therapy is, especially in the younger population, is, and the father says, that's Bittel's man, I'm sitting learning Torah in the mirror. I can't come learn. I can't come and sit on and for hours doing family-based therapy. Maybe I'll come in the day she's there, admitted to the emergency room. What do I do about the rest of the time? I'm sitting learning Torah. It's Bittel's man. It's a waste of time. I can't do that. So you have to work with those kind of things. So these, they're all subtleties in terms of approaches to that the content... The content may be sometimes expressed in a different way, but the process itself and the principles are precisely the same. And to think that we're different is not, we have to be sensitive to where the person is coming from. We call that cultural sensitivity, and we have cultural sensitivity to everyone in Israel, but sometimes not so much the Orthodox population. And that should be there as well.
I'll just add a note. The point that Dr. Strauss just made about the halakhic questions that come up, the matters of Jewish law. So there actually is quite a body of, I would say, literature, but it's really Torah Sheba'al Peh. It's really more oral literature, if you will, a spoken tradition in rabbinic circles about how to deal with issues like this. There has long been an awareness that these are cases of pikuach nefesh, these are cases of saving a life, and that the patient needs to be able to do what the patient needs to do in order to get better, and that it's irresponsible to point a finger to halakha in a way that's going to prevent treatment. This goes back to, I've done quite a bit of learning in terms of the area of OCD, and I actually have a book in my car that I got back from someone I lent it to that quotes extensively from Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky and his responses to questions. It's Ode HaDrachot, if you're familiar. It quotes of Yaakov Kanievsky extensively dealing with questions that come up from people who are dealing with anxiety disorders and OCD. So issues like, you know, when I start to pray, I don't think I have proper concentration. And these are people who will go on for hours trying to get the right concentration until they can convince themselves that they said it right. Or issues of kashrut, and I'm scared that I mixed the meat and the dairy. And the rabbis who respond to it, Rav Kanievsky stands out for his stature within the halachic community. But the rabbis who respond to these questions are very aware of the severity of the issue, and at least the ones that I'm familiar with, they're very willing to step in and say, Adkan, say enough, now you have to do ex, Rav Asher Weiss, who was at Shari Tzedek Hospital, made headlines a few years ago with a similar response that he issued regarding the issue of OCD. I don't know within eating disorders who the big names are who are addressing it, but I do know that in general, in the area of mental health, it's viewed as serious as physical health. So that's what I've seen.
I'll give you an interesting dilemma. Ethical dilemma, conflict between medical ethics, Israeli law, and a halakha that we come across with this issue. So the law in Israel that you can only admit a person against their will if they meet two conditions. If they're psychotic, if they're out of touch with reality, or then is an acute danger to themselves or others. So if someone comes to the emergency room in Israel and they're not psychotic, they're just extremely depressed and suicidal, by law, according to Israeli law, I have to let them go. So what happens if someone comes...
They have to be both.
Psychotic
not one
and
or the other.
Not one or the other. Simultaneously. So what happens? So Israel's very, very strict on the issue of autonomy. We can't force patients to do things. We can't. Agree. But what happens in this case? Anorexia is not considered a psychotic illness. So if someone brings in their sibling who's 20 years old to the hospital and they severely emaciated, let's say BMI under 8, under 12, whatever, doesn't matter right now for the numbers, but they severely emaciated, they need to be admitted to the medical ward even because they're on the way to dying from the anorexia. Now, there's an acute danger to themselves, right? Not to others, but to themselves. But they're not psychotic. And they refuse. So now, according to the Israeli law, I can't admit them against their will. According to halakha, and the Tzitz Eliezer, who's the standard medical halachist who most of medical halakha goes according to many cases in Israel, who was the rabbi of Shaarei Tzedek, he's niftar a few years ago, he said that there's no problem admitting a person from the point of against the will, from the point of zachin alav shalom b'fanav. In other words, you can do something meritorious for someone because they're not in a state that they can make a decision for themselves. So now I'm sitting in the emergency room there in my nosha. I have a kippah on my head. The law says one thing and halakha says something else. So what do I do? How do I manage the situation? Because anorexia is not considered a psychotic condition.
I have to answer that, sorry. So I would actually challenge that. So while it's true that many people with anorexia are not psychotic, there is some data to suggest that there is a group where that you can they actually have measured, I can send you the article if you'd like, that they are psychotic. They are psychotic. If you believe that you can absorb calories through your hands, through your skin, and you will not touch something because of that, and you genuinely believe that that is a psychotic symptom, I would actually argue that anorexia, particularly in severe form, has impaired reality testing. I would call them psychotic.
Okay. So according to the strict law in Israel, it still would not be considered. It's not one of the classified, because everything is classified. It's not considered classified as psychotic illness, even though the treatment, in many, many cases, we use antipsychotic medications, especially early on. But sometimes because of the side effects of the medication that you actually increase the weight. But that's another story in and of itself. But basically, it's gone to court. It's gone to court, and judges have said you can admit them against their will if they agree. That's exactly the psak of a judge a couple of months ago. So there was in the previous government there was a Chaver Knesset, Rachel Adato, a doctor herself, who tried to change the law to say, okay, that's right, you can only admit the person if they're psychotic and endangered to themselves, unless they're anorexia, we can include anorexia. But what's the problem? 3-4 months later, after she tried to get this law through, the government fell and she was out of the Knesset. So the law didn't go through. But it's something we're still working on today. So these are some of the subtleties, and you try get it to a situation that you try help and convince them, and you try work through the courts. But it's not so simple.
What about for children and adolescents? Is there a different law?
It's different because you get the parents to sign.
There's a law that will.
So you can. So that's why I mentioned in particular as a 20-year-old. Because if it's an adolescent under the age of 18, the parents can sign them in against the will.
I want to just take a moment and move from halacha to hashkafa and thinking about Judaism and its approach to appearances and to beauty. And specifically in light of the holiday of Hanukkah that will, God willing, be with us in just a little over a week. Does the paradigm of Chanukah, in which we speak about Hellenism with its attention to the body, is that, and by contrast, Judaism, which is with a focus on the inner, or on the light, the inner light of a person, is the occasion of eating disorders within the Orthodox or the Jewish community generally, is there a attrition, a erosion of Jewish values that this represents in some way, and that the attention to the externals within our community, is this becoming something more like the Hellenist ideals as opposed to, what you might say, our classical Jewish ideals?
Okay. One of the dangers of bringing in Judaism as part of a conversation for this and for many issues, but certainly when you're dealing with mental health, is that really, the joke is you ask two Jews, you get three opinions. But the truth of the matter is that if you ask Judaism a question, you will never get one answer. Judaism is a multiple minds on pretty much everything. And therefore, you can't really define the Jewish view on beauty and say, well, Greeks like beauty and Jews don't, or something like that. The truth of the matter is that you have sources within Judaism that are sort of anti an emphasis on beauty. You know, the prophet Shmuel goes to coronate a new king, and he sees this fine young man, Eliab, and he's so impressed, and he says, that's got to be the one who God has chosen. And a little voice in his head, God says to him, no, you're looking with your eyes, I see the heart. Don't be impressed by physical beauty. Or, of course, the classic line from Mishle, Sheker Achein Behevel Hayofi, charm is false and beauty is vain. But for every source like that, you can bring another source on the other side that talks about the importance of beauty, right? When the Imahot, the matriarchs of Israel, are introduced in the Torah, we're told, make sure you know, Rachel hayta yifat Torah v'yifat mareh, Rachel was beautiful, and Yosef was handsome. And same words are used. I just translated them into English as beautiful and handsome, but the same words are used in the Torah. Daniel is described for his beauty. You have a passage in the Gemara that talks about the beauty of Sarah, the beauty of Rivka. There is an emphasis on them being beauty. And for every source you can bring that says that we de-emphasize beauty, you could bring another source that says that we are in favor. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenberg, who you mentioned, was asked about cosmetic surgery. And his feeling was that cosmetic surgery, by and large, not talking about a case of reconstruction after a burn or something like that, but in general, he was very against it. He said pursuit of physical beauty is an unworthy goal. And yet here we are, we're going to celebrate Hanukkah and talk about the concept of Hidur Mitzvah, of beautifying the Mitzvah. And seeking to get an even nicer menorah, and using the nice oil, and the nice oil with multicolored oils in the for each night. The reality is that that we do, as a religion, emphasize beauty, whether in the context of mitzvah, whether in the context of the righteous person. The Vilna Gaon's position was that we should beautify that which is worth beautifying.
So where does it say that beauty needs to be seen?
So that's another question. Where does it come from that beauty has to involve being thin? Right? Who's to say that that's what's beautiful? That's cultural.
I grew up in Africa, and it was the opposite. Mm-hmm. In the Zulu culture, being significantly what we would call overweight is considered beauty. Mm-hmm. There's something about our society that's taken on that as sin. The question is, where does that fit into Chazal?
I want to tell a story. When I was just beginning, I was talking to a colleague of mine, and she was Jewish from the United States, and a generation older. She grew up in the 60s, and she told me this interesting story, which was when she was growing up, when girls turned 16, for their sweet 16, the Jewish girls, when they turned, got nose jobs. It used to be the rite of passage, you got a nose job. And it wasn't because the parents thought their daughters were ugly. It was because they were an immigrant population, and they thought that their daughters would be safer and more likely to succeed if they looked less Jewish, right? If you think about, these would have been parents who had been around World War II, right? And there was this concept of trying to pass as that it would be safer. And, you know, this may not hold for Israel, but I think there's still something to that, not just for Jews, but for lots of cultures who are the minority in a larger white sort of European culture where, you know, being fair and tall and blonde and thin is the ideal. We can talk about why that's our ideal now, as opposed to what it's like in the Zulu. But I also think as families are trying to fit in, as they're, you know, if they're achievement-oriented, there's something that gets absorbed in their safety in looking like everyone else.
Right. But to go back to Dr. Strauss's question about thinness and is that, you know, a value within Judaism, while I wouldn't say thinness is, there are enough sources that people can use to not just justify, but to idealize not eating. You talked about it a little bit before, but you know, when the Rambam says you shouldn't finish everything on your plate, right, against every Jewish mother and grandmother who ever lived, but the Rambam says don't finish everything that's on your plate, and there are sources that talk about not eating in the public eye, you shouldn't eat in front of other people, or not eating in a way that is rude, or in a way that's messy, or in a way that brings disrespect and disgrace to your, you know, things like that, in a normal and healthy situation, that's not going to lead to a problem. But to someone who already has a control issue as manifest in terms of food, they're just going to seize on to that. Well, the Rambam would really be impressed with me because I left three quarters on my plate. They're, you know, that sort of a thing. I don't think it's the thinness per se, but I think it's the control of food. Yeah.
So we've spoken a little bit about the complications that religious devotion plays on the management of eating disorders. Is there any positive side that spirituality, religiosity plays in the management of medical, of the eating disorders? In other words, is there a way that Torah can be utilized to facilitate care in these types of cases?
Well, I'll just mention to you, first of all, part of the rehabilitation, just like we, you know, rehabilitation of someone in a general psychiatry ward is art therapy, music therapy, dance therapy, part of what we use is Torah therapy. And we bring someone in who has a background in therapy and learns with people and uses learning as a kind of rehabilitation to come back to regular function. With a purpose around issues of eating, for example, and healthier function. But I just want to just mention, before I forget, medical epidemiology's best kept secret is that religion protects against so many different things in one's life. And I would expect that it appears there as well. Our results from eating disorders seem to be much better than the other eating disorder clinics around the country in Israel from an outpatient perspective. And I don't think it's because our staff are so much better. I mean, it could be that as well, but I don't think it's that. Okay? And I think it's because by nature of the population, there's something about the Orthodox population that's more open, I wouldn't say so much to suggestion, but more open to authority, to say, okay, I'm listening, I'm ready to work with the program, and isn't that oppositional or defiant stance as sometimes we see against families. And I'm not saying in a pejorative sense that they're better, it's a cultural difference. But in terms of epidemiology, we know that just in general, in Israel, religious people live longer and are actually healthier. But that's from another perspective. For example, there are less car accidents because they only drive 6 days a week and not seven. There's less drug abuse, there's less drug overdoses. There's something about the community. There's something about the community and the family that keeps the people together. So it seems that our results are a little bit better, but I think it's because of the bigger picture of the context of being a religious community. But the basics, the principles of eating disorders and treating eating disorders in terms of family base and all the other things we discussed are really the same. And that's important to remember.
I think I would just note two things. One, the comment that I made before about how it's a double-edged sword, because if you're going to bring in Torah on one side, you have to know that there are sources they can bring in that are on the other side. And you know, there are all sorts of Torah sources that can be brought in to support treatment for all sorts of mental health issues, depression, addiction, OCD, and presumably this. But there will be sources that are on the other side, and so you have to know who you're playing with, especially because I don't know. Actually, I'll ask you. With other mental health issues, we find a strong prevalence of this, particularly in people of higher intellectual function and higher academic success. Is that true for eating disorders also? So you're talking about people who may well know what you're going to tell them that's positive, and they know the other side, you know, at the same time. That's one point that I think is worth recognizing.
But yeah. But they also know what's right.
Yeah.
They're smart. They know if they're playing with pulling in things just to make their argument. And you can always capture them in that discussion. They know what they're doing.
Just the other point that I think is worth mentioning, Dr. Strauss talked a little bit about it, but a friend of mine is a rabbi in New Jersey, and he has a daughter with an eating disorder, and he has spoken on the topic, and he referred to a 2005 Stanford study in the Journal of Eating Behaviors, which actually, it's titled Spirituality Among Young Women at Risk for Eating Disorders, and it notes that women with strong spiritual/religious practices cope with body image issues differently from others. They will pray more, they'll meditate more, they'll learn more, and they do find that to be helpful. So there is this idea that the ritual aspect provides an outlet that can be very important.
There's another interesting thing which I'm still working with and I'm not so sure about, because it's something that we're doing, but we're doing it as an outpatient. But now that you're moving into a day program and an inpatient, we need to consider. And I discussed with Dr. Pinchas yesterday, and she doesn't necessarily agree with the approach of what my staff want to do. But, and this is interesting, because by nature of the population, the ultra-Orthodox young adolescent girls don't have so much access to internet and everything, what we're trying to do is that we're managing in the group kind of context where the girls, young girls, don't have an opportunity to discuss with each other kind of the eating disorders. So they will have groups, but they'll have groups around an activity like photography or study or horticulture or something, but there won't be groups, psychodynamic groups or groups in general, behavioral groups even, talking about the eating disorders. So we won't expose each other to learn from each other. Now, that would not work in the non-Orthodox population, but because of exposure to media and exposure to internet and exposure to television, etc., you can learn from what's out there. But these young ladies don't have that exposure because none of them have cell phones. None of them have cell phones. None of them have TVs at home. So we're thinking that if you don't expose them to each other in the context of group therapy, they're not going to learn from each other. That's something I'm still playing with, because that's something that some of my staff really, really want, because there are really two programs that do that, not in the secular world, in the they're not in the religious world, in the secular world. I mean, they're trying with looking at maybe we should adapt it for the Orthodox world. But that's something, as I say, it's still in a process.
So I would say something, tweak it different. I would say, if you're talking about outpatients, I would totally agree with you. But in fact, in outpatients, I tend to think the family is where the work comes in, less so in groups with kids, for any reason. But if you're going to do day treatment or inpatients, they're going to eat with each other, right? Because you're not going to have like eight different staff eating individually, or maybe you are, I don't know. But you're into a different kettle of fish when you're doing day treatment or inpatients, because they're essentially living with each other. So they know what they're all doing, right? And I think what you want to do is move the group dynamic to a place where the kids are at least being responsible enough that they're not helping someone else's disorder. And that's what you have to consider. You don't necessarily have to do that in the group, but that's what you have to think about. Because when they will always find time to be alone, and you have to think about how you're going to, and I think this is partly where religion can be helpful. You want to leverage their moral integrity as well. That having an eating disorder doesn't relieve them of not doing harm to others. And if you don't say it, if you don't speak it, if you don't expect it, the kids don't necessarily go down that path, because we're supposed to be guiding them. And it's easy to get caught up in a competition, I would say. And I would say a couple of things, which is religion also, epidemiologically in North America, is better for your health as well. All the studies show that as well. I think science and medicine tends to veer away from wanting to discuss spirituality because it's not, you know, even though the research is scientific, somehow talking about spirituality is not scientific. And yet, I would say if you're treating a person, you need to treat the whole person, including the spiritual part of their lives, to not talk about it, to not see how that relates to their recovery or how they can leverage it to help them move forward. I think it's a missed opportunity. You know, I've been a doctor for a long time. I have things that have happened that I cannot explain through science alone. You know, and to pretend that doesn't happen, I think diminishes the work.
I mean, there is an ethical problem, at least in North America. I don't know how it translates in Israel. But you know, Viktor Frankl talked about logotherapy being not religious, and he studiously tried to make that distinction between spiritual and religious. And one of the reasons he gave for that was he said that under the Hippocratic Oath, and his oath as a physician, he's not allowed to impose his own beliefs on the patient. So how do you talk to a patient, you know, sick kids, about religion without in some way imposing on them something from outside?
So I actually was put in my place one day by a patient who told me, don't think you're so important and you're so smart that whatever your religion is or what your belief is, that somehow I'm going to suddenly become that. That's what my patient told me. Like, we also have to remember they're people.
Except what we can do is just teach skills. And if you go back to Viktor Frankl would say, between, in life, it's not what happens to you at some point, but how you deal with it. And that's what we as adults can give their children and these young adolescents these skills to say, you know, but, and then this is the quote from, you mentioned back, Frankl, to say, between every stimulus there's a response, and between that stimulus and response lies our choice, and that's our freedom as individuals, and that's where our character develops. So you're saying to these adolescents, you're saying, okay, so you're faced with a stressful situation, whatever it is, in this case it's eating disorders, your challenge to come out of this and to respond to this in a way that you decide is what's best for you and what's best for you in the long term, because they know. It's like saying, you know, two people can go through the same car accident and both lose their legs, and one can be destroyed for the rest of their life, and one said, I have my arms, my brain, my mind, I have family, and sometimes their life is more fulfilling and meaning than it was before. So you're taking the same situation, you're saying, using the values, and these, you know, Viktor Frankl wasn't religious, but these are, the Maharal wrote about this. This is not something that's new to Yiddishkeit, the concept of taking a challenge, and what can I do with that in that situation? And it's manifested in many different aspects of our lives. So while the children have they right there, we as adults have wisdom, and hopefully as medical professionals as well, we can help guide them.
So I want to follow up on these points and ask, how important is it for the care of eating disorders to have a staff that reflects the population when it comes to religiosity? Because if you have an Orthodox population that you're being cared for, how important is it that they're, the people treating them are also Orthodox?
We might have different opinions.
That's a sensitive issue.
I will not take the religious eating disorder patients because the parents do not want me, as a religious nurse, to know what is wrong with their child, even though when we get handover on all the patients on the floor, we know exactly what's wrong with each and every patient. So I never care for the religious patients for that simple reason. Yeah. Parents do not want the room there, and perhaps the only unit in the hospital with three Jewish nurses, but only three from nurses. They do not want any of the
from
nurses in their
rooms. I think Rav Moshe Feinstein said quite clearly, when it comes to treating, for example, as a psychiatrist in general, if as long as a psychiatrist or psychologist is a good psychiatrist and psychologist, they're not going to let their religious opinions affect the manager. And I think that even though in our program, for example, most of our therapists and are in fact Orthodox, it's not a, definitely not a, an absolute requirement. Even though we believe that you have to understand where the person's coming from, and cultural sensitivity is important. And we see that manifested in many different areas of psychiatry in general. OCD, for example, is the most fascinating example, that if you don't understand halakha, and you see someone with severe OCD in the area of of Hichot Nida or Nadarim or Nitzilat Yadam, etc., etc. There are many different aspects. You're going to treat that as psychosis. But if you understand where the person's coming from, you understand that it bothers a person. So it's ego, what we call dystonic. It bothers a person, and they see it as irrational. Then you know you're dealing with obsessive compulsive issues and not necessarily psychosis, and therefore you manage it accordingly and correctly. So I don't think it's a requirement for the staff to all be orthodox, but I think it is a requirement to be culturally sensitive, understanding where the person is coming from.
I've always said that as a psychiatrist, you are your stethoscope. You have to use yourself in the relationship and learn from what happens. So, there is a psychiatrist who works with adolescent girls with eating disorders who comes from Ghana, who is black, and a man, and who is an immigrant, and who knows nothing about Canadian culture. But he gets to ask questions no one else gets to ask. Even though he's been here long enough, he knows what the answers are. But sometimes asking the right questions, just out of curiosity, trying to understand and trying to get it right, helps families even start to make sense of what they're doing themselves. Because, a lot of, I think, what we do is about making the unspoken spoken so that the families can have those discussions amongst themselves.
I think it's, to pick up on points that both of you made, I don't think they have to be orthodox, but they have to be ortho-friendly, mm-hmm. Educated, or, have a rabbi as a resource they can consult, for a few reasons. One is the issue of comprehension, which you already mentioned, to understand where the problem is, what is normal and what's not, but also to understand where the sources of danger are. Right. If you have somebody who is an alcoholic, and they say, "Well, I'm going to go to the synagogue," so as a counselor, I might say, "Well, that's wonderful that you're going to go to synagogue. It's spiritual and so on." Not realizing that depending on which synagogue you go to, before, during, or after, or all three stages of the service, they're going to be running into people who are drinking. It's a terrible thing to say, but it's a reality. There are also issues of trust that are really important here. A psychologist, psychiatrist, therapist who isn't really culturally aware, doesn't understand the values of Judaism, can end up saying something which will completely lose the trust of the patient and never realize it. So you have the patient who's dealing with obsessive compulsive disorder, right? And they have a fear that in the event that they mix meat and milk, and for them they're thinking like there was meat here at some point in the past and now there's going to be dairy here at some point in the future and therefore I have mixed meat and milk, then God is going to strike them down. And the therapist says, without realizing it, something insensitive like, "God doesn't care about that." Well, that's it. You've now lost the patient. Right? You have to know where the lines are, and then also as a matter of practicality. Right? If you're talking about things like exposure response, right, therapy, ERP, with somebody who has OCD, knowing what you can have them do in exposing them to their trigger and what you can't have them do requires either that you have the knowledge or that you have someone you can consult who will be able to help with it. So I think, I don't think orthodoxy is necessary. I think awareness, being sensitive, that sort of thing probably is.
I agree. The important part is being, I like that word, ortho-friendly, right? And non-judgmental, because I think all that stuff you're talking about, we need to hold clinicians to a high enough standard where that would be standard, that if you're working with someone who you don't know the details of their culture, that you have a way of asking and finding out before. Like, we should all be held to that standard with everyone that we work with. I think we need to.
There's another principle, though, when it comes to eating disorders, which I think is important. In psychiatry, we all talk about being non-judgmental, and in general, that's a good thing. When it comes to eating disorders, I am being judgmental because I'm seeing that, not eating is a good thing, and I can't be so open-minded that my brain falls out of my head to say, everything's okay, I don't want to judge. So I don't want to be, I can be judgmental by saying that, I don't think it's the right thing. But there's a big difference between non-judgmental and non-condemning. So I can say, okay, I'm being judgmental for myself to say with this eating disorder practice, it's a problem because it's really not good for your health. But I'm not going to condemn you in your day-to-day practice because I want to try and understand you and try and work with you to come to get better. So there's a subtle difference. It might be in some ways semantic, but I think it's an important difference when it comes to the subtleties of managing eating disorders. I don't want to be condemning because then I've lost the person. The dynamic of a relationship is gone.
You spoke earlier about the stigma around mental illness and the stigma specifically around eating disorders. I wanted to ask, what can a community like this one do to change or to at least move the bar when it comes to the stigma around eating disorders?
I just want to say one thing about the stigma first, which is I think there are some unique aspects of stigma around eating disorders, because I would say that even if we all agree there's stigma around mental health, I would actually argue that within mental health and mental health care providers, there is a second level stigma around eating disorders. So I would say, like in healthcare, there's stigma on the healthcare side, the healthcare professionals, and on the mental health care. Like, if eating disorders are really the orphan disorder, no one wants them. Everyone, it stigmatizes them. And I think that's a really important thing to remember.
Why is that? Why would that be stigmatized?
So
it's harder to treat.
I don't think it's harder to treat. I don't. But there's this belief that it's harder to treat, that the patients never get better, they're unpleasant, they're always tough. And none of that is true. I would tell you, I only work in the eating disorder world, and I will say I love it. I love the patients. I love the families. It's extremely rewarding. But I think part of it is fear. So the healthcare professionals are uncertain about the mental health aspect that makes them want to reject. And the mental health care people are worried about the health care. You know, so there are some hospitals in the city where, you know, if with our mental health act, let's say you wanted to, force someone to be in hospital because they have a mental health disorder, and we can do that in Canada, and they're a teenager, you can't get them admitted to the hospital because the only place you can put a kid on a form is in the psych unit. But the psych unit won't accept eating disorder patients because they're too medical. You can't take them to the pediatric floor because they have too much mental health like issues and they're on a form, so you can't admit them there either. So like you can't go anywhere with them. And I think that's an expression of that fear, because you have to be comfortable with both aspects. The second part is that it's an illness that happens to young women. And there are all kinds of stigmas related to that, and beliefs about mental health and hysteric girls and hormones, and that are also unfounded, I think. Do you have a question?
Two questions. Is it okay if I ask a question? Just have a question. Stigma in Canada or Ontario, mental health is not funded. Does that probably aggravate the entire problem?
So actually, mental health is funded. It's funded through hospitals and through mental health care facilities and through Ministry of Child and Youth Services. You're right that mental health isn't funded, like if you wanted, and it's only funded through certain professions. But, so for instance, you could, if you had a child, I'm just going to pick a random thing, and you, no one found, and you went to Keystone Mental Health Services there, you could get mental health services for free for your child, absolutely. The problem is that most of the money is hospital-based or institution-based, and it has not been well managed. I think it has not been well decided how that money's spent and who provides treatment. And I think the other thing is that we still in this country think that somehow mental health is less important or less severe, and we're reluctant to spend as much money. So if you look at the healthcare spending on mental health care as opposed to physical health care, it's literally a fraction. It's like less than 10%, you know, of the whole healthcare budget, even though it's a common serious illness. So we also are trying to, it feels like we're always trying to get our mental health care on the cheap. And so there's not enough money to go around. So the problem is not that it doesn't exist. The problem is that the access is really limited because it's really underfunded.
The second question that I had, I feel bad, I don't want to offend anybody when I say it, but my experience with other people with mental illness has been negative. So because of that, I will have, I'm having a hard time being very, not non-judgmental, but very, like, oh, no problem. Let's say I'm looking at my children. I would not want them to marry somebody with a mental health issue because the people that I know have not taken care of themselves. So it's like a double-edged sword. I'm sure they could be helped. But if they're not helping themselves, do they actually have a higher risk of not helping themselves? Or is that true, not true?
I would suggest one thing, which is probably the people with mental health disorders of various types that are taking care of themselves, you know. You just don't know they have a mental health disorder.
Okay.
Right? Okay. That's what I would say. Because often it's the people who are severely ill or who have lots of other environmental reasons or can't access that choose not to do the things they should be doing to help them stay. And some people choose that, right? But I think the people, there's more mental health issues around you than you know, but most of it is mild to moderate. Most people get help or try to do what's right, and
but
you would never know.
But that's conflicting with what you all said before, that there's a stigma, so nobody's really getting help. So are they getting help or they're not getting help?
So I think lots of people are getting help on, like, either they're paying privately or they're getting it secretly or they're not telling. I used to have a patient, a young Orthodox girl, who would come to see me in 6 minutes. Because 6 minutes is a hospital, you could be there for any reason. You could be visiting a friend. No one would know you had an eating disorder. And we talked about, like, if I had gone into private practice and she was coming to a psychiatrist's office, she would never come, just in case someone saw her walking into a psychiatrist's office.
I like to tell the story. A few years ago, they asked me to teach research to psychiatry residents. I said, let's do some research. So I went, there was a conference of 300 psychiatrists in Israel. And I asked the psychiatrist, with the 30 diagnoses that we have in psychiatry, to self-diagnose themselves. Mm-hmm. So what percentage of psychiatrists self-diagnose themselves as having some form of psychiatric illness? What would you think? 5%? 10%? 89% said it's some form of psychiatric illness. I'm one of the 11% that's completely okay, but 89% said it's some. And you know what? That's no different to the regular population. We all have a bit of depression, anxiety, but the question is how much does it affect our function? And how much do we go get the help that we need when we need it? That's part of the human condition.
Right, I want to add one note regarding stigma that I think is important. I'm not sure how to solve it, but I think it's important to recognize. And that is that our role models within the observant community tend to be painted hagiographically, right? They're all saints and they're all perfect. And they all started learning Talmud when they were in the womb and never stopped. And they were wonderful children all the way through Cheder until they had to leave Cheder in kindergarten to go learn with a Rebbe because no one in the school could teach them. I'm speaking of the male role models. The female role models are analogous, I assure you. But the reality is that the role models we are familiar with, whether you're talking about the rabbis and rabbitsins or the community leaders, it's extremely rare, and I'm struggling to think of even one, that you'll hear about, and they had a child who was struggling with something, or a spouse, or themselves. It's not because it didn't exist. It's because it's not talked about, because it doesn't fit the picture of these models for the community. I suspect it would go a long way towards destigmatizing it if people were aware that those who are held up as the role models deal with this also, have it in their families also, and it's and it becomes much more acceptable then for someone to stand up and say, I've got it too.
And don't forget, not all mental health disorders are lifelong. Yeah. Some come and go. Some come once. Think about postpartum depression. Right? It's a very common consequence of having a baby. Almost normal. It's just about, like, the range, right? When does it become depression? And even if you don't treat it, it may be a very difficult time. It may affect your parenting. But it does resolve, right? So, you know, it's about how it's treated or how it's hidden or not hidden, right? But most women, if they've had more than one or two children, will have at least had one episode of postpartum depression. So whether it's acknowledged or not.
Just to add one thing, I think that the stigma...
Louder, please. Louder.
Sorry. I think the stigma in the Orthodox community is particularly about infertility as well, because there is the shidduchim part of it, and knowing that this female can't get a period, and this might affect fertility, and I think that that falls under the radar a lot, because you don't want to have the stigma of psychiatry, psychiatric issues, and then there's a fertility issue on top. So I think that that's a very big piece of why people don't go for help, and will come to the dietitian, because the dietitian is sort of just a nutritional issue, and we can kind of get that. But I think that that's a big reason why people aren't getting help. And I think that the other piece of it is to really educate the community on what eating disorders look like. Mm-hmm. Like that it's not just these people who are starving themselves and they get to steal, you know, whoever, you know, made a lab used to not eating. That's actually the minority of eating disorders, that most young females who are Jewish are actually in, a lot of them are just struggling with disordered eating, and that's sort of not so uncommon. And I think that that needs to be really brought to the fore, as in our community, we don't believe in this. We do not, we stand for not valuing our, you know, Western ideals of we embrace females and males for different reasons of being healthy and nourishing ourselves and nurturing our bodies, and that's what Yiddishkeit stands for. And I think that we need to make that statement more as a community as well, because I do think that we fit into, ironically, it's not actually a Jewish ideal to be. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but it's not, like, we have to differentiate it, that it's safe to be of all shapes and sizes within our community as well.
So I'm just going to repeat a little bit of what you said, just for some people who may not be able to hear because of the direction. But one of the issues that was raised was the issue of infertility, and that can be part of the stigma, particularly because eating disorders and eating chaos and low weight can lead to infertility. There was an interesting study done at an infertility clinic that showed that a quarter of the women who were visiting infertility clinics were infertile simply because they were low weight. The other issue is that you don't even have to lose a lot of weight before you start to see problems with women's fertility and women's cycles. So there's another study that shows that a number of women, young or girls, will lose their periods before they've lost any kind of significant weight. And that sometimes it's the eating chaos. So the sometimes restricting, the sometimes not. And you can imagine physiologically what that message to the body is, right? That food is not reliable. This isn't the time to be allocating resources to another life. So there's a lot of issues related to infertility. And that sometimes what happens, rather than going to see a psychiatrist, because it's the double stigma of mental health and infertility, that they will go see a dietitian. Because it's a nutrition thing, and that is more acceptable. And then the other issue was about how actually in Yiddishkeit it's about, you know, nourishing the body and being proud of that, and that we need to bring that more to the forefront. And I think make it more spoken in front of our children. And you know, there are things we know, but if we don't actually speak about it and reflect it, sometimes it gets lost in everything else. Is that close enough?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you also say just one little last point. I think that we are a religion of fasting and famine and feast. Mm-hmm. So it's not as like the level of fair dieting in the community is very much higher than the general population.
So it's already 8:35. So I want to just take a couple more questions and then we'll stop. Here's Helen. Let me repeat the question to everyone.
So we are talking about eating disorders as a mental health disorder, but are there any physical triggers that can cause this? And of course, I would say, I think about eating disorders as a collision of events. And absolutely there can be physical reasons. So there are... there's a couple of things. One is, and some of these ideas are very controversial, so there are some illnesses like OCD and anorexia would be one of them that may occur as an autoimmune post-streptococcal infection issue. Very rare and still controversial. There are also, I have some colleagues who would say, if you really listen to the story for some kids, any kind of weight loss, even if it wasn't intentional, if they lose enough weight, can trigger some of this. So, a kid gets mono or they get sick and they don't eat for a while and they're kind of these anxious kids, and they lose a bit of weight and then someone compliments them. So then they think, I just want to stay like this. I saw a kid like that who, every time she got her braces tightened, it caused so much pain, she pretty much didn't eat for a week, and she was a bit heavier, and she lost a little bit of weight, and everyone complimented her, and then she would try to keep it.
Reinforcing.
Right? So those kinds of things can happen. The other thing that can happen is, there's a group of eating disorders that aren't about weight or shape, that are about things like extreme picky eating, kids who have had, let's say, they almost choked on something and now they're afraid to eat. But some of these kids, the ones who, let's say, got sick, if you don't eat for a while and then you go back to eating more, you will feel bloated and you will get stomach upset. And sometimes for kids who are really sensitive to like all that, they notice every twinge, they misinterpret that. And it's a reason to eat less, because when they eat less, it doesn't hurt. Right? And they need to be taught that actually it's just your system. It's kind of like if you were in a cast and you took your cast off and you walked a lot, the next day your muscles might be sore. It's not a reason not to ever walk again, right? You have to, because the stomach is a smooth muscle, you have to exercise it. There are all kinds of things. It's really a collision of events. It's never just one thing. And I would actually argue that there's a particular age, somewhere between, let's say, 12, 11 to 14, that if a kid diets for any reason, long enough and hard enough, where the brain is developmentally puts them at great risk of just developing an eating disorder. Like, they're just vulnerable physiologically.
Yes, in the back, go ahead.
I think this is
louder.
This is an idea of mine, which I have no academic basis. But you mentioned earlier that we always, or at least I hear, a great deal about eating disorders in young women and the values and the culture and the appearance and all that. But then when I hear you professionals talking about it, I hear talk about not so much about what people want to look like, but about control. And I am wondering if within the Orthodox population, and particularly when you see Orthodox young women, is it an issue of control over their bodies? Is there an issue here, perhaps, of, within our culture, a certain overemphasis on women's bodies? Maybe not on being thin, maybe not on being Hollywood, but on your collar has to be up to here, and your skirt has to be down to there, and you're wearing the wrong tights, and this is the only kind of socks that we permit. Whatever the issues are within whatever context you are, that the overemphasis, there was a certain girls group that about 8 years ago, was called Ateras. Anybody hear about it? They said that girls should excel in tzniyas the way their brothers are taught to excel in Torah. Well, obviously, you can't compare the two, and I'm not going to go into the reasons if anybody wants to talk about it. But the drumming to young Orthodox female people of tzniyas, is that something that is causing in some vulnerable people, or that might be causing within some vulnerable people, them to reassert control of their bodies in this context?
Okay, so again, I would say yes and no. Like, it is a collision of events. It is a focus on the body, but it is also a kid who is eager to please and a good girl and perfectionistic. And sometimes one behavior can suit many purposes, right? On one hand, it's about taking care of the body and eating healthy. Another, it's about meeting some ideal that she has about how she should look or worrying about the shit-off. But at the same time, she can discover that it's a way of controlling things. Like, it's not, like, these are smart, you know, lovely, complicated girls and boys. And it's rare that I see, like, one thing is the reason for this disorder. It is really that's actually the, you know, the challenge of it, I would say, that it's a collision of events. It's what the culture says and how they responded at a particular age and what their biology was and whether they could diet and how their families reacted and whether someone complimented them or not. Like, it's all of it together. It's not one thing. And I think, so yeah, that plays a role in it. But it's not the only thing that's happening, and it wouldn't be, it's rarely enough that one thing would lead to at least a serious eating disorder. It might lead to someone dieting or whatever for a while, but you need more, I think.
I think that we're really at time now. For those who have additional questions, please come over to the panelists afterwards. But I want to give each of the panelists just some time just to summarize, to leave us with just an idea that perhaps we should leave with when thinking through eating disorders within the Orthodox community.
I'm not so sure I can really add more to what you said tonight. Once again, it's a privilege to be here to meet with you, with my fellow panel members. Just to say that mental illness and issues are out there. We talk about mental illness, but I think we also need to talk about mental health, and that we can also do amongst young people. And there's stuff out there, and it's part of the human condition, and we need to address it, and there's nothing to be ashamed of. And eating disorders happens to be a particular issue that's not dealt with well in the Jewish community in general, and in the mental health profession in particular. And that's something that we're trying to address in our new hospital that we are building, that we've just built.
The only thing I would do is, first of all, just note, Rabbi Straffler and Shari Shemayim have done quite a bit, I think, in terms of publicizing and talking about mental health issues. And I think that's something that really should be recognized, because it's not an easy thing to do, and it's vital. But I'd go back to what I said in my introductory comments at the start of the program about the importance of the community and the ways in which people can help. You know, we never did get back to the question, so now I'm going to ask you. Perfect. You know, in terms of what you can say to someone in this situation, but I think it's vital that people do say something, and you know, that will help destigmatize, and it will also help to provide support. If you want to tell
us. And I was going to say thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure. And I will do almost anything if it's going to raise awareness or help even one person with an eating disorder. And I think every one of us could make a difference. And don't assume that you don't know anyone. If you do the numbers, if you know six teenage girls, at least one of them has an eating disorder.
What do you say?
So I'm coming. So I think the rules is to be genuine, to be authentic, and to speak from where you're feeling. Right? I am worried about you. Right? Not when I look at you, I worry about, you know, how nourished you are and whether you are getting enough in, and you look unwell to me. Is there any way I can help you? Is there anything that you need from me? I have a patient. She talks a lot about how she has young children, and it's such a secret that she has an eating disorder that if she had cancer, everyone would be offering to take her kids to school so she could go get treatment, or bringing casseroles and putting it in the fridge so that she wouldn't have to make dinner so she could have gone to treatment. But when it's an eating disorder, it's a secret. And mostly everyone I've talked to with an eating disorder, like, it's a relief. It's actually a relief if someone is coming from a place of just, do you need any help? I'm worried about you. What can I do? Because most of them also know that they're having troubles. You know, we just ran a conference in Whitby for teachers, and we actually asked people with lived experience with eating disorders to come and speak about that experience. And afterwards, I asked them how it was, because they spoke in small groups. They said it was the most empowering experience, for once, that instead of everyone pretending not to see, kind of like in your quote, like, people just ask them questions, like, in a non-judgmental or non, like, how did this happen? What is it like? How can I help you? It was a relief to just be fully themselves and not have to be secretive about it. And I think people know when your intentions are good. But the important part is not to speak about what you're assuming in them, but what you're feeling. It breaks my heart when I see every time you come here and you never join the family and really eat and enjoy. And I can see that you're really struggling. Like, just what you see and how it makes you feel in terms of your caring for that other person.
So I want to thank each of our panelists for their remarks and delivering to us so many insights in addressing eating disorders, and also the call to action that each of you brought forward in terms of this issue within our community. What more can be done and should be done. I want to just close with an advertisement for the next segment of the mental health program that will be hosted here at Shari Shimon on February 6th.